Good morning, and thanks so much for that very nice introduction, Dave. I actually was a nurse negotiator in New York City, and I learned a lot about negotiation, which has been very good for my marriage and also for my career. But I'm thrilled to be here today, and I really appreciate the invitation. Just to build a little bit on what Dave said, included in our membership are also patient groups, employers, and so we really run the gambit of different stakeholders in healthcare, pharmaceutical organizations, folks who are working in the IT space, and what they share is this incredible passion about primary care. So I want you to all know that there are people across the country that really care deeply about what needs to be the foundation of a high-value health system, which is primary care. And they, and they really are very, very focused on this, and it gives us all a great deal of energy and excitement to be working with these leaders across these 64 organizations. So I'm happy to tell you that 2019 has been a banner year for advancing primary care, and I hope to make that case to you today and also to invite you to join us in continuing the success into 2020. So I mentioned that we are all about primary care and making the case that it's the foundation for the future of our healthcare system. And we're focused on the quadruple aim, which I know you all are as well. We've also defined the vision of what do we want primary care to be, and it's embodied in these seven principles. About 100 organizations helped to develop those principles. So it was the primary care clinicians, but it was all those other stakeholders that I talked about. 340 organizations have signed on to those principles. I invite you to do that if your organization has not, and it's a great opportunity to talk about what do we want from primary care. They update principles that were developed in 2007, and a lot happened over a 10-year period. These were introduced in 2017. And here's what was different. Well, first let me start with what remained the same. Basically, Barbara Starfield's four C's were there in 2007 and are still there in 2017. But what changed is this focus on the team. You know, the physician-patient relationship is obviously still very critical, but we've brought the team into the mix. Also, you know, in 2007, we hadn't really understood the importance of social risk factors or social determinants of health. Of course, public health had understood that, but perhaps medicine was just really catching up to understand how much that contributed to the health of the population. We also have a much more robust understanding of what patient and family engagement and how that contributes to health outcomes. And then finally, we added value because we all need to be stewards of these precious resources. And you all have a very important role to play with respect to the whole stewardship piece. As Dave said, we are predominantly a policy and advocacy organization, but we also disseminate research and best practices. We view our role as educational. You all can sign up to get our quarterly newsletters and also to attend our monthly webinars, which are all about primary care. We generally get about 400 people on those webinars, and they run the gamut, all different kinds of topics. We also do some TA with practices. Our history, you know, we were formed in 2007 because some employers and physician specialty societies got together and they basically said, primary care is not working. We need to reinvent the way it's delivered and the way it's paid. And they came up with this notion, although they actually adopted and adapted a model that the American Academy of Pediatrics had developed, the patient-centered medical home. And so we really are, my predecessors, I will give them a lot of credit, were the ones who really took that model, got consensus across all the primary care specialties, and then brought together all those stakeholders and did team-based advocacy around the model. And as you can see, very successful. The recent AMA survey shows that 42% of practices that have primary care within are in a PCMH. And I'm just curious, in the room, how many of you are practicing or working in a PCMH? I'd say that's probably more than 42%. And family medicine, it's even higher. What about the efficacy of this model? I mean, you all are in the academic settings, many of you do research, and you know, there's a lot that's come out in the peer-reviewed literature about the efficacy. We have also published some reports. This report, which came out in 2017, looks at some key variables, and 1,500 journal articles were reviewed. 50 of them met the Graham Center's test for being, really strong in terms of their validity and reliability and the like. And what we found was positive, but not always consistently positive. Yes on costs, yes on ED utilization. Quality was a bit mixed, and inpatient was a bit mixed. I was 3 months into my job as the CEO of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, which it was then called, now the PCC. And when I saw these results, I have to tell you, it gave me some pause. Okay, this model is working, but is it really working as effectively as we would like? And sort of tucked that away, and as we were developing our policy agenda, really thought about, well, what are the barriers for this model being effectively implemented, this model and other models of advanced primary care? In 2018, we took a different tack, because up to this point, we had always looked at the efficacy of the patient-centered medical home. And I wanted to know, how does PCMH relate to this other big health delivery innovation, accountable care organizations? They've been around for about as long as PCMH. And what was interesting to me is no one had looked at the relationship on a quantitative basis. There was some qualitative research, but mostly, even though these innovations interact in the delivery system, researchers had looked at them separately. You know, what's the efficacy of PCMH? What's the efficacy of ACOs? No one really looked at the interaction between the two. And what we found on the population health level is that ACOs that had a high preponderance of docs who had practiced in a PCMH, they hit it out of the park on the quality measures. And mostly, they also did very well with respect to costs. It makes sense. If you're in a PCMH, you really learn and understand how to manage populations. That's exactly what ACOs do. But no one had looked at this interaction. Now, some other studies have come out that really augment this. We know that physician-led ACOs do better than hospital-led ACOs. It's not a big surprise, but we really hadn't had the research to demonstrate that. And also to say to policymakers, hey, why are we standing up these hospital-led ACOs? They're really not effective. And I will say that CMS took notice of this report and other studies. And when they updated their regulations related to ACOs, they really incented the physician-led ones. So these kinds of studies do have an impact on how policymakers evolve programs. Okay, so I said that, you know, it gave me pause when our 2017 report results came to light. And really, you know, we've come to the conclusion that while PCMH has made gains in terms of improved population health and holding down costs, the model is underpowered. And like lots of things in healthcare, there's lots of reasons why it's underpowered. And these, I think, are three of the leading causes. First is mostly primary care is still paid and patient-centered medical homes on a fee-for-service basis. And that impedes your all's ability to really transform care, because you know, you're in this visit-based model, this face-to-face visit-based model, and you don't have the payment that allows for you to be more flexible in the way you deliver your care and also to build out your teams. Secondly, we have really insufficient investment in primary care. That is not a surprise to all of you, but I will tell you, because we don't have a standardized way to really report that, this is not a well-known fact policymakers. They, in terms of policymakers and decision makers, they have some notion that we under invest in primary care, but without a number that is well recognized and standardized, it is not something that they spend a lot of time thinking about, or not enough time in my view. Also, we have a lack of alignment across the medical neighborhood, and I'm sure you experience that in your delivery system. So, what does it mean to say that we are still generally on a fee-for-service chassis? The AMA study suggests that only 24% of physicians have any kind of capitation revenue in their practices. It is higher for those PCPs in patient-centered medical homes and ACOs, but still, in those arrangements, about 60% of your practice revenue is fee-for-service. And a really important study was done at the Harvard Center for Primary Care to show that you actually need almost two-thirds of your practice in a prospective payment to truly transform the way you're practicing, to get away from reliance on a face-to-face visit, and to build out the kind of clinical teams that can provide a comprehensive set of services. So we are slowly moving really towards value and away from fee-for-service, but in my view, not fast enough to give primary care the kind of flexibility to really transform practices. CMS is a big mover and shaker in this area, and obviously as the largest payer, they can really affect the market. And they are making a lot of, they're introducing a lot of new programs to try to move towards value. You heard some of those from Amy Mullins yesterday from AAFP. They're also investing more in primary care. And what I would say is that, a lot of this work was started under the Obama administration, and it's been continued under the Trump administration. So this is an area where we really see a lot of bipartisan agreement that primary care matters and that we've got to do more in the primary care arena. Even to include work to shift dollars from specialists towards primary care. Amy alluded to this yesterday. The physician fee schedule that will go into effect in 2021 with the G codes that she talked about to enhance E&M services, the modeling that's been done by a number of different groups show that that would be about a 12% increase for primary care. So that's pretty sizable. And it helps, I hope, to attract more people to primary care and to help orient our system more towards primary care. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, their largest investments to date have been in primary care. Again, started under Obama, continuing under this administration. Show of hands, who is in CPC Plus? Okay, some, there's good representation. This obviously builds on the former model, CPC, where we did see some gains in quality overall. Once you accounted for the investment in the model, you didn't see reductions in costs. And so a number of changes were made to this model, and we hope that when this concludes, in 5 years' time, we will have a model that can be replicated because we'll see those cost and quality gains. And then most recently, CMMI rolled out, whether you're a lumper or a splitter, if you're a lump or two major models, if you're a splitter, five major models in April related to primary care. And I'm just going to talk, do a little deep dive about one, primary care first. Is anybody here in the room considering embarking on this model? Show of hands, a couple of folks. Okay, terrific. You know, this is a model that really is designed for practices that are comfortable with risk. And it is not for every practice. It's meant to, spur folks to have a larger percentage of their revenue be in a prospective payment. There's still a visit-based component. And there is adjustment of the prospective payment, four different levels. So the upside is up to 50%. I think that there aren't going to be, lots of practices that meet that, to be honest. But there is that upside, and then there's also downside risk of 10%. And I know that might be a bit daunting for practices, but really trying to move towards these kinds of arrangements. We're cautiously optimistic about it, but also a bit concerned that, to be honest, that CMMI has not already identified private payers so that you can have that payer alignment. They're working hard to do that now in the year ahead. This starts in 2021. So we'll see how many practices decide to sign up. We need a lot of practices to be able to demonstrate whether or not this model is effective. If not enough practices sign up, they're going to have to go back to the drawing board and continue to work on this model. But they are putting, time, staff, and resources in trying to innovate in the payment and delivery space. So I think that is really very positive. It's obviously not enough, however, just to change the way we pay. We also need to invest more in primary care. And I noticed that there was a couple of puzzled looks in the room when I said, policymakers don't truly have an appreciation for how much we undervalue primary care. In my travels, the health economists know this, and people within primary care have a deep appreciation for the underinvestment. When you get outside of those bubbles, if you will, and I ask people, what do you think we pay primary care as a percentage of total healthcare spend? I get wildly different answers. All the way up to 20% of our healthcare spend goes to primary care. So people really don't know, because we don't have a standardized measure. We don't regularly report it, unlike the OECD countries. And I ask you, how do you improve something if you don't even know how, and even if you don't even have a standardized measure? If you can't compare and benchmark, very difficult to do. So we're really on this campaign to raise the visibility of what we are investing, to try to understand what investment means in terms of patient outcomes and costs, and also to give policymakers at the state and national level the tools to, if they don't like how they're prioritizing spend in the health systems that they direct, now they can have the data to understand what that spend is and to make some changes. So 5 to 7%, I don't know. Once you say it, and I don't care if it is the most sophisticated policymaker or someone who, is right out of graduate school, they all agree, paltry. We want primary care to do so much. We want primary care to integrate behavioral health and to deal with addiction and help us connect patients to the community. And could you integrate oral health as well? Manage multiple chronic conditions, help people with their end-of-life choices. I could go on. Well, talk about a disconnect. 5 to 7 cents on the dollar? You want primary care to do all those things? And here's what you invest. And so, I think one of the central things that we do as an organization is really get people to understand that they really need to reorient and prioritize primary care in order to do all those things that they want primary care to do. So, in January of 2018, remember I said I was bothered by that underpowered PCMH model. We decided that we were going to start working with states who have the authority, because they oversee and regulate health plans, if they are granted it through either legislation or regulation, to require health plans to spend more on primary care. And so since we embarked on this, six states have passed legislation to begin reporting on what they're spending on primary care. And 10 states in total have introduced legislation. Two have actually set standards or goals for what they want their health plans to be investing in primary care. So I think this is an incredibly exciting, this is incredibly exciting news. Getting legislation passed is not easy. Six states this year, and most of them on their first time, passed legislation. So there truly is some excitement and momentum about this notion of why don't we reorient our system towards health and away from just paying more for hospitals, pharmaceuticals, and specialty care. Let's really reorient our system. And we're helping to give states the tools to do that. The states that are, and first off, show of hands, I'm just curious, you know, how many of you had even heard of the Primary Care Investment Campaign? Okay, so some, but we need a lot more people to be talking about this. We are aware of 9 states that are thinking about introducing or have already drafted legislation for next year. One of the challenges, however, is it is an election year. Despite that, we think it's really important to get the conversation started, and if not next year, 2021, I think can be another banner year, but hopefully next year. And what's interesting is that these six states have set up, for the most part, multi-stakeholder collaboratives to resolve what is the definition of primary care, and also what do we want to do with those additional dollars. And I would suggest to you that if you are in a state that is thinking about this, make sure you bring all those stakeholders to the table. Because when medicine tries to do this alone, you're not as successful. It looks much more of like a self-interest campaign, as opposed to doing the hard work of convincing all these other stakeholders that this is really what they want for the health of the population, for the people who work in their, you know, if they're employers, for the people who they employ, the states who are trying to balance their budgets, the patients who recognize that they can't get the kind of primary care they need, for the patient advocates who recognize that primary care is the way to close some of the huge inequities that exist in our system. So, you know, the states that have been able to move most successfully are the ones that really developed this multi-stakeholder campaign to convince their legislatures that it made sense to start reporting this measure. And then in the case of Rhode Island and Oregon, setting a goal. Other states that have been particularly successful are those that have a strong foundation of patient-centered medical home and have evaluated those patient-centered medical homes and have something to show the legislatures about how advanced primary care can really make a difference. And also states that already have an all-payer database because they've got something to work with. We're constantly asked about the evidence base related to primary care, both by national and state policymakers. You may all know this, but I was surprised when I took this job to find out that there is no one place that is gathering all of the evidence, synthesizing it, and making it accessible to policymakers. So there is a burning need for an organization to take this on. We would love to do it. We're looking for that foundation funder who thinks that this is an incredible thing to do, or if you will, any of you have any suggestions. But it should not be that we've got primary care evidence over here in family medicine and over here in internal medicine and over there in pediatrics, back here at some university, over there at another university. We really need to get all this information together, and we also need to translate it for the policymaker audience, because that is how you can convince policymakers how to move an agenda, in addition to personal anecdotes, which I do think have tremendous impact as well. To help raise the visibility of our underinvestment in primary care and also to provide policymakers with some helpful information, our evidence report this year, again funded by Milbank Memorial Fund, and we're very appreciative of their ongoing commitment to the PCC, and also we partnered again with the Graham Center. We did a report on state investment in primary care, cut by payer type. And this was a report that the data source is the ARC Medical Expenditure Panel survey. It allowed us to calculate US rates and also 29 states. So the cell sizes were too small for all 50 states. This is 88% of the patient population. But the states that don't appear in the report, we've heard from them. They want their own data, I get that. What it did allow us to do, I mean, the ideal data set would be to use claims data. However, using MEPS, we could actually get Medicaid, which is great because states really care about what they're spending on Medicaid. In the report, we use both a narrow definition of primary care and a broad to look at spend. Narrow is, you know, the medical primary care is narrow, and broad includes all of the above in terms of medical, but then nurse practitioners, PAs, psychiatrists, behavioral health, and also OBGYN. And then in the report, we look at what is the relationship between spend and key patient outcomes. This is our analysis. And the denominator, we talked about the numerator, the denominator is all costs. And what we found, and all of this is on our website and free and available for download at no cost, we found huge variation in what was being spent. This is the total cost in the state. So 5.6%, that's very much in keeping with what we see in the research literature. And it varied between 3.5 in Connecticut up to Minnesota 7.6. If anybody is here from Minnesota or familiar with Minnesota, they've had over a 10-year investment in patient-centered medical homes, and it really does show up here that they've invested a lot in primary care. With a broad definition, and I'm sorry, somehow this is not the correct data. Broad definition is the overall is 10.2. The lowest is in New Jersey, 8.2, and again, Minnesota knocked it out of the park at 14. So given all this variation, and you see the variation when you look at Medicaid and when you look at Medicare, this starts a lot of conversations at the state level. How do we compare to similarly situated states? How do we compare across payer type? And we know that this has been very helpful. Washington State just came out with their report on primary care spend, and they had their own calculation of how they came up with their number, but they compared it to this report. So it's starting some real conversations. We have quarterly calls with state leaders across the country who are working on this. Our last call, we had 60 leaders sharing information about what they're working on and how to advance this kind of legislation. They do ask, however, the leaders, so what difference does it make with respect to spend? And we, again, working with the Graham Center, did some analysis to look at its effect on patient outcomes. And I'm going to show you three slides in a row, but they all are the same. Again, this is ED visits, and what you see is the states that spent more had fewer ED visits. The states that spend more on primary care had fewer hospitalizations. And the states that spent more on primary care had fewer ambulatory sensitive hospitalizations. Now, I will say that we did not control for any variables here, population, age, severity of conditions of the population, and the like. But this is the sort of relationship you see in the research literature, that if we invest more in primary care, we're going to control and we're going to improve population health and control those downstream costs. We recognize that the study has some limitations. I know that there's a lot of researchers in the room. We would love for you to get some claims data, replicate this study, look at its effects on population health outcomes. But we do think it's a starting point for state leaders. And if we waited for the perfection of the research design, we'd be years away from talking to state leaders and getting them to move on this issue. The bottom line is, we spend so much less on primary care. This is not news to you. The OECD countries that report this on an annual basis average 14. They go up to about 19%. We know in this country, when you look at health plans, it could be 3%. It could be 19, a Kaiser. So there's huge variation. So we know this not only at the state level, but also at the health plan level. And we really think that this research has direct implications for policy. We're moving to get this out into the public discourse. After our study came out, Lancet did an op-ed about it. We wished that JAMA or the New England Journal of Medicine had done that, but we were pleased that it was in JAMA. We're also really pushing this notion of a standardized measure and had a health affairs blog with a leader at Anthem. And the reason for that is each state should not have to reinvent the wheel. That takes a lot of time. But also, if we're going to have comparative data and really be able to benchmark one state against another, one health plan against another, one ACO against another, we really need to have a standardized metric. The other thing I neglected to say, and this is really important, is that these initiatives are not about growing the healthcare pie. They are about increasing investment in primary care, but maintaining our current spend and hopefully down the road, reducing that spend. So it does mean that it's a shift, it's not an increase. And consequently, you can imagine that there will be some that aren't going to be happy about that shift. And we've already seen states that have not been successful because of, major stakeholders in the state pushing back. And that's another reason why you really want to have this multi-stakeholder group, because when the hospitals say, this is not such a great idea, you want to have everybody else saying, oh, yes, it is. And without all those stakeholders, you really don't stand much of a good chance to move an agenda like this. They are the ones that continue to have a lot of the clout in state legislatures and in Congress as well. So it's only by joining together with all the other stakeholders that I think we're going to advance this strategy. In addition, we don't hold this out as a silver bullet strategy, which we tend to do in healthcare. Oh, this is going to be the thing that solves everything. We should learn by now that that is virtually impossible to have one thing solve everything in the health system. But very importantly, with primary care investment strategy, primary care has more resources at its disposal and has a comprehensive team to deliver a comprehensive set of services. You know that hospitalizations are going to go down. You know that ED visits are going to go down. And so what might hospitals do in that circumstance? I mean, they are in a market. How do they recoup those losses? They'll raise their prices. So you need to also have some strategies to keep hospital prices in check, or else we will balloon what we're spending on healthcare, and that won't be good for anyone. So our next steps, we're going to continue to work with our 64 members and the broader primary care community to help those states that want to advance this legislation in 2020. We're also going to continue to work with CMS and CMMI about shaping the primary care models that are coming out of the Innovation Center. You heard Amy say that it's really important that the rule that they put into effect, that has been finalized, that will go into effect in 2021, related to E&M codes, that somehow doesn't get overturned in the year ahead, because there's many that don't want to see that shift occur, and so that's going to be an important issue that we work on. And then we also are very much in touch with what the health plans are doing to innovate in the primary care space, what accountable direct primary care is doing. I don't think there's one size fits all for primary care delivery and payment reform. I think there's a lot of models, and we're very excited to work with you and others in supporting the continued reform of payment and delivery and getting more investment into primary care so that we can really achieve the shared principles, equitable health care, better population health, care that is coordinated and integrated and really meets our patient needs, all of our patients, and all of their needs. Thank you, and I'm interested in your questions and comments.